Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another show. I got a couple articles here out of the local newspaper, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. It's names and faces. An emotional Michael Douglas says that surviving a cancer scare several years ago gave him a new vitality as he settles into his senior years. Douglas, 71, spoke about his health at an AARP luncheon Thursday celebrating the Academy Award winner's storied career and said, "It's good to be alive." Douglas battled stage 4 throat cancer in 2010. Once you come out of that end, you have a resurgence of certainly of energy. He told the crowd at the Lee Bernardin restaurant in New York City. Douglas had his own celebrity cheering section as he was given AARP's Movies for Grown-Ups Lifetime Achievement Award. Besides his wife, fellow Oscar winner Catherine Zeta-Jones, his Ant-Man co-star Paul Rudd, his Fatal Attraction co-star Glenn Close, Blythe Danner, David Hyde Pierce, Zach Posen, and Jan Winner attended. Douglas called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which he produced his most profound work. He noted that it was turned down by every Hollywood studio before its eventual release. He also attributed his longevity to picking the best film to work on instead of the best role. "It's the greatest compliment I could get to see your name, and I don't know what I'm going to get, but it's going to be good," he said. His voice cracked when he thanked his wife for her support. The couple separated a couple of years ago but reconciled, and Douglas noted that two were celebrating their 15th anniversary this year. Douglas will receive AARP's award officially at a ceremony in Los Angeles in February. Another story here. Ex-fiancée of actor Charlie Sheen, who has sued the actor claiming he didn't disclose that he was HIV positive until after they had sex several times, and he was physically and emotionally abusive during their relationship. Scott and Ross, a porn star who performed under the name Brett Scott Rossi, filed suit against Sheen on Thursday, claiming assault and battery and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Ross first met Sheen in November 2013 and agreed to have sex with the actor for $10,000. They got engaged in January 2014, but their relationship ended later that year. Her lawsuit states that she and Sheen had sex 5 times before the actor told her he was HIV positive. As a result of this exposure, Ross has suffered serious and emotional distress from a reasonable fear she will contract HIV, the suit states. The 2.5 Men star publicly disclosed he was HIV positive on the Today Show last month, but said he disclosed his status to all sexual partners. He also vowed during the appearance that he would not pay to settle any claims from partners claiming to expose him to the virus that causes AIDS. Ross's lawsuit was filed one day after Sheen was supposed to pay her $1 million to settle all claims against him under a draft agreement the actor never signed, according to court filing. Sheen's attorney, Marty Singer, wrote in a statement that Ross claims already are being addressed in private arbitration. Charlie Sheen intends to vigorously defend the lawsuit filed, the singer wrote. Numerous witnesses will dispute each and every claim made by Ms. Rossi. Okay, now it's time to read from good old Wired magazine. Hacker TV exposing security flaws on YouTube. Hold on, get to it. In an age when hackers trade techniques on the dark web and sell them to intelligence agencies, Sam Kamkar takes a more entertaining approach, YouTube. A display of the 30-year-old's digital mischief, the video series Applied Hacking teaches some 50,000 subscribers flashy hacks, and no household item is immune. He's tweaked a kid's toy to open garage doors, a 3D printed a master lock cracking robot, devised a fake charger that could snip keystrokes on the wireless keyboards, and even hijacked cars' smartphone apps to remotely unlock and start the vehicles. I just assume everything's vulnerable, he says. It's a pretty safe bet. Camcar gained notoriety in 2005 as the creator of the Sammy Worm viral code, which he added unwittingly to added unwitting MySpace users to his friends list and displayed the text, "Sammy is my hero," on their profiles. It worked too well, ripping through the site and bringing Camcar a million new friends in 24 hours, along with a visit from a very unfriendly Secret Service agents. He pleaded guilty to computer tampering and was banned from using a computer for 3 years. After that ordeal, Camcar approaches his research with strict transparency. He says he alerts firms to their vulnerabilities in their products, but doesn't profit from his hacks and won't accept security consulting work to avoid a conflict of interest. I want to do what I think is right. That's hard when someone's paying you. Instead, he takes his reward from a modest fame, close to 3 million YouTube followers so far, or 3 million YouTube views so far, and the thrill of solving the hidden puzzles he finds in everything he touches. On to our next story. Fuck it, we'll do it live. Angry nerd. In December, the coolest sci-fi fantasy of the 70s is finally getting a high-profile revival it so richly deserves. If you're excited as I am, yell with me. The Wiz Live. What you thought about? What you thought was something about something else? No. The all-black reimagining of the classic Frank L. Baum book was the toast of Broadway when it first appeared and remains the greatest cultural touchstone of the Gerald Ford era. How many Tony Awards did Star Wars ever win? None. That's how many. The Wiz strikes back as the latest musical broadcast live on NBC. It gets better because next month Bach is jumping on the trend by restaging Grease. That's exactly the sort of high-risk, high-reward programming we need. When it's good, the added immediacy makes it transcendent. And when it's bad, it's terrible, oh, sweet free Jack, it's gloriously, unforgettably terrible. Watching a live musical on TV is like being in a NASCAR race. There's always one flat tire or note away from disaster. That's what I call must-see TV. Listen up, NBC, if you want to get up the ante, I got two words for the 2016 holiday musical. Captain EO, don't worry about issuing a check. Just pay me in Warhammer 40K figurines. Okay, let's see where we're at. Unveiled Voices. Muslim women speak out. You know you've reached the peak of Islamophobia when a presidential candidate says he's uncomfortable with a Muslim in the White House. In response to Ben Carson, Twitter user and Libyan-American Muslim woman Hind Amri pointed and laughed, launching the hashtag, "How to Stop a Muslim President." First idea, all bacon White House. She's one of a growing number of Muslim women who are using social media and a healthy dose of humor to speak truth to preconceptions. Hind Amri, when Bill Maher claimed that ISIS fighters aren't outliers in their violence, she tweeted, "Five of the last 12 Nobel Prize peace winners were Muslim. According to Bill Maher, we're all Peace Prize winners." It was retweeted 7,800 times, but her best joke was that Princess Leia is a headscarf short of being Sharia compliant. Zineb Bint Yunus, responding to concerns that women in Naqab need rescuing, the Canadian blogger who wears the face covering collected selfies from others like her. The results pretty boring. If you think covered ladies playing street hockey or riding on jet skis is boring. 10, Lisa Ahmed and Zahra Nurbakish. Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast. There are so many things I don't know about being a Muslim until the media told me about it, quips Nurbakish on her podcast. She's proud of her many younger women who reach with their chatty format. We speak to them in a way that no one has before. Sana Sayyad, producer at Al Jazeera All Digital Facebook Centered Channel, where she coined the term faith washing when people say the conflicts like Israel and Palestine are merely religious. Social media, she says, allows all of us Muslim women who veil and don't veil sometimes, veil everything and veil very little, to critique popular representations. Getting to my next story. Flirting on LinkedIn is less weird than on other social media. After all, your resume vouches for you in a substantive way. Whoa, hang on. Let's first poke at the premise of your question because the implications here are huge. Notice how casually you presume your resume offers more than a substantive representation of your basic humanity than, say, all the tweets you've tweeted, all the digital artifacts you've amassed on your Facebook page. Think of the photos on Facebook alone, you in a rowboat with a gentle-looking man playing a banjo with whom we understand to be your deceased too young father. You being silly, but not obnoxiously silly, just innocently, enduringly silly. In the Halloween aisle in the big box store, you tagged in a photo of that kid you mentored on one summer as he graduates from Berkeley. You're climbing a goddamn mountain, like pickaxes and stuff. Do these substantially communicate the substance of your life? Don't they vouch for your potential dates as a safe, non-creepy, sufficiently together human being, a sympathetic soul tumbling through the fundamental experience of being alive and looking for companionship? Or is it better to be captured with a line like this, 2013 to November 2014, Senior Operations Associate, Mobility Inc. Hold on, I need a drink of water. Try to keep that throat clear. You seem to think it is, and I'll admit begrudgingly you may have a point. Because the lines have blurred between our work lives and our emotional lives, our careers and our intrinsic selves. We subconsciously gauge a person's character by their professional standing. Our experiences and attitude toward each other may only sometimes be relevant to our love lives. In fact, the two can feel crucially interwoven. The best startup founders are those who operate out of passion and devotion with a kind of hyper-monogamous obsession. On the other hand, we all feel obligated to work on our relationship with the same myopic, idealistic intensity. And it can feel natural to apply the lessons we learn relating to people in one realm of relationship to the other. Take, for example, Jeff Weiner, LinkedIn CEO. I confess I'm not a LinkedIn user, but I've been reading about Weiner, and I have to say, he seems like a wonderful guy, a principled, thoughtful man who is very grounded. Jerry Maguire type things like, I've never been title-driven, and for the most part, I've been purpose-driven. He also reads a book by the Dalai Lama, contemplates the difference between compassion and empathy, and practices mindfulness techniques, like being a spectator to my own thoughts, which enhance his ability to relate to and motivate his employees. He calls his style compassionate management. In an essay he wrote a few years ago, Weiner described leaving work one evening, feeling proud of the strides he'd made only to be felled by the epiphany that he'd been uncompassionately neglecting his wife. He was working so hard, he wrote that night, when my wife would try to bring up a day or talk about things we needed to get done, I would reflexively say something to the effect that it had been a long day, I was exhausted, and we could talk about it some other time. For as hard as I worked to manage compassionately at the office, I was not always actively applying those same approach with my family. So Weiner applied the same compassionate management style to his marriage and made things right. I worry that sounds off like the emotionally tone-deaf insights of a stereotypical tech baron, but trust me. The way Weiner explained it, it sounded cool, real. And you know this too. I worried that I'd gush about this in this column about Weiner's coolness and realness, only to learn later that Weiner is not actually cool, not real, and the truth is he's an imperious Genghis Khan or grade A misogynist steroidal jerk. And I sat down to Google Jeff Weiner LinkedIn jerk and was happy to find as a result a post singling him out as a counterweight to the industry's other CEO jerks. So that was reassuring, even if the post was published on LinkedIn. But even that can be interpreted as a testament to Weiner's character, because Weiner, I learned, who has a vision to expand LinkedIn from a bland resume farm into a successful publishing platform. I will go even further. I wouldn't be surprised if a man as smart as Weiner already knows all this, knows that we live in an age where one of the prime romantically assuring things about another person is that the thing that vouches for them as the best potential mate is that they're trustworthy, hardworking, and successful. And therefore, he also secretly knows LinkedIn could be the ultimate dating site, though he wisely stops short of saying it. Instead, he just dog whistles about the potential to attentive users and eagle-eyed investors, thus preserving the opportunity to pivot the company explicitly in that direction should all the climate change and need arise. Recently, for example, he told an interviewer, our core value proposition to members has helped them connect to opportunity and touted the power of his platform and to enable capital, especially human capital, to flow where it can best be leveraged. Isn't he talking about dating? What about setting people up? When Tevi and Goldie's daughters sang "Matchmaker, Matchmaker, Make Me a Match," weren't they basically asking the same kind of social networking platform to send their own human capital flowing toward whichever boy would give them the highest valuation and invest? Why shouldn't you flirt on LinkedIn? Why shouldn't your love be the one of the opportunities LinkedIn connects you with? So yes, you're right. And you've taught me a lot, and you and Jeff Weiner both. I can clearly see now how we all tied ourselves into this knot of careerism, affection, equity, and sex. Maybe that's just the way it has to be. I'm remembering now what happened to Jerry Maguire, the real Jerry Maguire, who showed up in that living room shivering, trying to win back his wife, and who also happened to be his business partner at their sports agenting startup. How he told her, "You complete me," but more important, there was a line that he slipped right before that famous line. Suddenly, in the middle of his monologue, he was compelled to say, like a man giving a keynote speech at a conference, "We live in a cynical world, and we work in a business of tough competitors." Why? Why include that? What could Jerry Maguire possibly mean? I think he meant the internet is full of sinister strangers. It's a hostile place which we offer up your soul. But here I am. Look at me. View my profile, and I'd like to connect with you on LinkedIn. Okay. Let's see. What else we got here? here's one. Look who's talking, whole new ways for animals to speak. Imagine you're a diabetic and you use your service dog trained to alert you if you sense your blood sugar is falling. These dogs are incredibly useful because diabetics can lapse into a hypoglycemia unawareness where they didn't notice their oncoming symptoms. The canines do and they intervene, but sometimes diabetic shock can emerge so suddenly that humans pass out. That's when a dog's in a quandary. Does he go for help? Because dogs can't talk. Unless they're sporting a wearable computer that helps dogs communicate with humans. Melody Jackson, a computer scientist at Georgia Tech, has been outfitting service dogs with computerized vests so that in an emergency they can find another human and pull a mechanical lever on the vest that triggers a message, "My handler needs you to come with me." When people hear this for the first time, they jump back 3 feet because the dog is talking. Jackson says, laughing, the dog can also do other tricks that are worth its wearable trigger, like SOS alert with GPS coordinates. And search and rescue dogs could do the same. It's all part of a curious new field called animal-computer interaction. It's not just dogs. Scientists are making systems to help humans and dolphins communicate and other crafting cat-human video games. Jackson is making sensors that monitor horses and broadcast signs of impending lameness. But as you might imagine, the action is, with the canines, who seem super stoked to get a doggy version of Google Glass. Dogs are, after all, highly social and already involved in assisting humans. Giving them more ways to talk is a no-brainer. For example, if a seeing-eye dog notices an obstacle, they can use Jackson's vest to tell their human what type of obstacle it is, a feat that was previously difficult. There's something more I've learned. There's something to be learned here about designing humans, too. Making tech animals means paying extremely close attention to the end user, because animals can't give a detailed feedback. If you get it wrong, you can't paper it over with clever marketing. You have to work within the animal's capabilities. For dogs, that means interfaces suited for their mouths and sensitive noses. Clara Mancini, head of the Animal Computer Interaction Lab at UK's Open University, devised a sensor that measures the sniffing pattern of cancer-detecting dogs as they assess samples, an indicator of how strong the scent they're picking up. When Jackson made a touchpad for service dogs to use in conjunction with their vest, the pups discovered it would pick up a signal if they just hovered over nose over the pad. One deduced this in 27 seconds. Humans aren't alone in their technological prowess, it seems. The point is that with the right interface, animals can tell us all kinds of things. Of course, we might not always like what they have to say. What if zoo animals tell us how they're doing? Imagine giving a universally farmed chicken, pigs, and cows the means to communicate their comfort level. Many farmers don't want to know what's going on with their animals, Mancini says. Consumers might not either. None of the millions of dollars we spent trying to communicate with intelligent aliens paid a return. And now it turns out the first extra species high-tech communication will come from creatures that share our living room. The day may come soon when your dog texts you at work with the emoji for "Sorry, I ate the rug." Says, enter party, control the lights with your phone via wireless hub. Who would want a little bit of a table bowl of color light? The Hue has got to be built in, has a built-in rechargeable battery so you can run it off an outlet at dinner, then take it with you when the party moves to the back porch. The LED array inside produces 16 million colors, letting you match it to the mood of the moment. Entertaining is about little things, the right lighting, the awesome playlist, the perfect glasses for that punch you've been concocting. Set the stage with care, and you'll give good times, will take care of themselves. Quick picks. The whole point of the instant camera is to deliver photos instantly. That doesn't have to mean low quality, though. This one comes with portrait and 170-degree fisheye lens attachments, along with built-in 27mm equivalent wide-angle variable exposure controls and a maximum aperture of f/8. You'll be the life of the photo party. Surface pros. Coasters have a simple job to protect your tabletops from nicks and water rings. Excuse me. And you could spend a lot more, but these stainless steel squares with their padded bases and clingy center get the job done and look sharp doing it. Conserve the coal through the magic of evaporation. Perfectly chill. Naturally cooling ice bucket and carpe. $90 and $65. The line of terracotta barware uses an ancient trick. Briefly soak the ceramic vessel in water before filling it and keep the contents cold for hours. As moisture evaporates from its porous walls, created by a Finnish company, Magizo, by ceramic designer Simon Stevens, this carpe and matching ice bucket are delightfully low-tech and high-style. Get a grip. Italy's Fresno party glasses. Some people can't hold their liquor. You don't want them dropping glasses at your big pool party. These polycarbonate tumblers are unbreakable, and the elegant ridges on the side inspired by Fresno lenses in the lighthouses make them less slippery. Wireless speakers give you more flexibility for enjoying jams. Home models let you pick songs from the couch. Mobile options turn your picnic into an EDM Festival. The House Band, $499. The best option for filling your house with quality wireless audio is Sonos. The newly redesigned 5-inch speaker in your spacious parlor with the vaulted ceilings and let it bring the noise. Plus, with this set, when you set up the device, it automatically times the rest of itself to space. You'll get the crispiest sound of any room in the house. Hammer of the Gods. Addition of Bluetooth and Spotify. Well, that was a little warning. Lady just told me it's time to go. So, hope you enjoyed the show today. Have a great night, great day wherever you are. See you next time. Bye.